Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, welcome tonight for our discussion on Australian politics in 2013. Both Troy Bramston and Nikki Sava make welcome returns to the Sydney Institute. They've been here before and I'm sure they'll be here again. They're well known to you, but I'll introduce them briefly. We're going to start off with Nikki Sava. She's a columnist for The Australian, writes every Thursday, and author of So Greek, Confessions of a Conservative Lefty, which came out a couple of years ago. And Troy Bramston is also a columnist with The Australian. He's the author of Looking for the Light on the Hill, among other books, and his most recent book, For the True Believers, Great Labour Speeches That Shaped History, is recently out, and Janet Grundy from down the end there has got some copies of that. So let's lead off with Nikki Sava, followed by Troy Bramston on the topic Australian Politics 2013. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. And thank you, Gerard and Anne, for inviting me back to speak at the Sydney Institute. And as luck would have it, or not, under roughly similar conditions. Last year I began by saying I was going to speak really quickly because I was worried I would get overtaken by events. I was. And here we go again. The Baillieu government's disintegration in a matter of hours proves just again how volatile and unpredictable the political world is. Almost exactly 24 hours after Troy and I spoke here last, in an incredibly dumb move, Kevin Rudd resigned as foreign minister and launched his challenge against Julia Gillard. If he had exercised some discipline and waited until after the Queensland election, as I and many others, including his supporters in caucus, thought he should, he might have been back living in the place he calls Bougainville, and which the rest of us know as the Lodge. Federally, so much has happened since then, and yet so little has changed. Labor is still trying to solve the insoluble, still tearing itself to pieces over the leadership, trying to choose, as one source said, between the mad and the bad. Bob Brown's departure has left the Greens in roughly the same poll position they were when he retired. Christine Milne has shown she is as clever, if not as charismatic as he was, by getting in first to separate from Labor. As in every fraught relationship, far better to be dumper than dumpy. Milne's goal is to run a blockade in the Senate to ensure the Greens exert as much influence over the next government as they have over this one. As of tonight, the Liberals are bunkered down behind Tony Abbott, trying desperately, with varying degrees of success, not to interfere in any way with the government's role in crises. The Liberals think things are perfect as they are, or they were till Baillieu quit. They have the threat of Rudd as opposed to the reality of it, acting like a human wrecking ball, protesting with all the sincerity he can muster that he is trying to help Gillard and win the election. And Wayne Swan survives as the government's chief economic salesman. Rudd's recycling would be a game changer. Ultimately, the result might be the same, with Labor losing, but perhaps not on such a grand scale. As it is, Brian Loughnane is planning two campaigns, one against Rudd and one against Gillard. If he's smart, George Wright would do the same. If Rudd does regain the leadership, he should immediately call an election to seek a mandate for whatever it is he wants to do, apart from bury Gillard. Any delay, and it will give people time to remember why they went off him in the first place. Some of his supporters are urging him to settle in for a period of governing, figuring people are sick of the endless campaigning. This assumes Gillard and her supporters will do what he didn't and quietly disappear so he can get on with it. It also assumes Rudd has changed and will govern differently second time around. Supposing he does, and a series of polls predict his ascension will give Labor a comfortable victory, the Liberals would confront the same dilemma Labor faces now. Do they stick with Abbott and risk losing three elections in a row? Or do they do what Labor did and install the man the polls say most people want, even though they feel about him much the same as Labor feels about Rudd? Actually, that is not quite true. There is not the visceral hatred of Malcolm Turnbull inside the Liberal Party as there is towards Rudd inside Labor. Although, to be fair, Malcolm hasn't been Prime Minister yet. Malcolm promises to be a team player. I believe him. I also believe him when he says he's the most popular figure in the coalition, although I still think much of that is Labor voters hoping he will rescue them from Rudd and Gillard. I also believe his leadership hopes still burn brightly. If the right circumstances arise, he will be in there counting and courting. Many of his colleagues will be prepared to listen, at least this side of the election. Abbott is not loved by his party in the same way as Howard was. People are staggered by Abbott's success, but it does not mean they will stick by him no matter what, and especially if the polls go sour. It is rare for politicians threatened with annihilation to assume the lotus position and sit while the house burns down around them. However, this is exactly what some Labor MPs are insisting they will do. The good news is they know what needs to be done after. The bad news is they might not be around to ensure it happens. Former members advising from the sidelines are about as welcome as former staffers advising from the sidelines. Around the middle of last year, when Labor was at a particularly low ebb, one senior Labor MP tried to describe for me the dimensions of the disaster Labor faced. Between the Hunter Valley and all the way up to Cape York, and potentially from Perth to Adelaide, there will be no Labor MPs, he said. Quite possibly there will be none south of Melbourne. Labor will be reduced to a rump in Melbourne and Sydney. This extremely pessimistic scenario was not supported at the time by even the most optimistic Liberal strategist. Until yesterday, the Liberals were hoping to pick up three seats in Victoria, Deakin, La Trobe and Corangamite, a couple in Tasmania and Western Australia, possibly six in New South Wales. If they get lucky, the LNP could pick up more in Queensland. Excuse me, just get a drink. But this all depends on how Campbell Newman is travelling. The senior member I spoke to is on a margin below 5%, and back then his internal polling showed a swing of double digits against him. We spoke again a few weeks ago, after the Prime Minister had announced the election date, a move he supported, and after Chris Evans and Nicola Roxon had resigned. Incidentally, in his opinion, those resignations were not simply a sign the government was unravelling. In his view, it actually was unravelling. He had slightly revised his assessment. His own situation had improved, and despite the evening up in the public polling from December to mid-January, nothing had shaken his belief that Abbott would win. "We have around 200 days left," he said. "The question is whether we will lose 20, 25 or 30 seats. We will certainly not lose less than 15 seats. And still, he will vote for Gillard because as bad as the situation is, he believes the alternative would be worse. As another Labor man says, he is not afraid of what would happen if Rudd lost, but what would happen if he won." So there are three factions dividing Labor now. Those prepared to vote for Rudd if it means saving the furniture, those who despise him and who will never vote for him, and those who can't bring themselves to kill another leader. Gillard supporters who complain bitterly of Rudd's treachery and who can't bear the thought of more bloodshed forget it is their treachery which is being repaid and which is now protecting her. It is this faction, the Doc Martin hemophobes, that the Ruddites are hoping to convince to commit one more little murder, especially when they realise that if they don't, the blood spilled could be their own. There is a subset, the whistlers in the dark, who think Gillard can still come good, but they are too few to matter. In fact, there's probably only one person in this grouping, and she's definitely not for moving. The Pope resigned for the good of his church because he realised he could no longer fulfil his duties. Ted Baillieu accepted he no longer had the numbers. Deep down, he knew the Premier's job was beyond him and that the government would probably do better without him. So he graciously ceded the job to a former leader. Gillard will never do that. Because of that, and because of Rudd's promise not to challenge, the mechanics of any removal are difficult. For starters, it needs to be obvious that Rudd has an emphatic majority in caucus. One Ruddite told me that if Rudd got to 60 votes, then a delegation, including Bill Shorten, would have to visit Gillard and tell her to go. He put it this way: Shorten doesn't want to lead it, but he wouldn't want to miss it either. If Gillard refused to go, then a no-confidence motion or a spill motion would be moved against her. We know Gillard doesn't believe in God, but I wonder if after all this she believes in karma. She will not find refuge in the pantheon of Labour leaders cast as heroes in defeat, like Gough Whitlam was, and as even Paul Keating is. She has failed to reform the party's structures. She is regarded as unprincipled, untrustworthy and incompetent. An unholy trifecta of a legacy for a leader to bear. It's no use saying Kevin's leaking and stalking is responsible, especially as the doubts about her honesty had their roots in his execution. It's no use blaming minority government, because then you have to consider how and why minority government came about in the first place. Even more offensive is the argument that she is unpopular because Australians are uncomfortable with a woman as Prime Minister. As if it's our fault. Other countries, Britain, Germany, India, Sri Lanka, Israel, the Philippines, Pakistan, Malta, have had female leaders and they cope. South Korea recently elected its first female president. You can't say their societies were more egalitarian than ours or more progressive than ours. None of those women complained, though, of the victims of sexism and misogyny, even if they might have been justified given the nature of some of the societies over which they presided. The case unravels too when you consider that, like Gillard, they surmounted all obstacles to make it to the top. I doubt any of them gave speeches accusing their opponents of being sexist and misogynist while defending another man who faced charges of it. It is true social media can be vulgar and defamatory, but politicians and public figures of both sexes and from all sides cop it. She's not the victim of her gender, she's the victim of her poor judgment. If Labor is defeated, the best thing they can do after they've finished telling us how terrible it all was, how hellishly stubborn she was, and how hopeless all those around her were, is to concentrate on getting it right for the next generation, by undertaking serious structural reform and expanding the gene pool. This does not mean excluding unionists, given some first-class politicians have come through the industrial movement, although I think Paul Howes needs a couple of decades to grow up before Labor even thinks about giving him a seat. Until the shrill sound of dueling dog whistles over migrant workers and asylum seekers pierce the air, we have been witnessing one significant and welcome change, and that is the emergence of the other Abbott. For far too long, we saw only one side of Abbott. That was Terminator Tony, helping destroy Rudd, bring a first-term government to its knees and cripple Gillard. It wasn't pretty, and he paid a price for it in terms of his popularity. It also earned him an extraordinary accolade from the legendary Liberal Federal Director, Tony Eggleton, who told me Abbott was probably the best opposition leader he had ever seen. And he's seen a few up close, including Malcolm Fraser and Margaret Thatcher. What makes a great opposition leader doesn't necessarily make a great Prime Minister. However, I believe Prime Minister Abbott, if there is one, will be a very different beast from opposition leader Abbott. He could end up surprising us all. At least I hope so. It puzzles me when people say the prospect of Abbott as Prime Minister scares them. What is it they fear he will do? Process refugees overseas or force them to live in squalor here? Do they worry he will impose a tax which inhibits investment, costs almost as much to administer as it collects, ties billions of dollars in funding to it in advance and blows out the deficit? Or maybe the fear is he will run up three of the biggest deficits in history, promise repeatedly to turn the budget to surplus, then on Christmas Eve reveal there is no surplus and probably never will be. Or maybe they think he means it when he says he'll abolish the carbon tax and worry the country will be engulfed by bushfires or floods. Maybe they fear he will wind back fertility or abortion rights for women, even if he wanted to and he insists he doesn't. Peter Credlin and his daughters won't let him. So you have to wonder whether Labor and some journalists too are not so worried about what Abbott might do when he gets there, but if he does get there, he could prove difficult to dislodge. We will never get a republic under him, but the way things are going, we'll never get one anyway, and certainly not with Swan leading the campaign. We might never get a bill to allow same-sex marriage, but if one does come along, it is possible he will have reversed his previous position and allows his MPs a conscience vote. Let's hope so. What I hope we get is demonstrable and sustained improvements in the health and education of remote Aborigines, because he knows something about the causes of the disadvantage and how best to tackle it. I hope he does stop the boats, because that will not only stop the drownings, it will stop that conversation. I hope he does stop wasting taxpayers' money and restores prudent economic management. Which brings me to one pledge he has made, which I hope he breaks, and that is to keep the same front bench he has now if he wins. His first obligation is not to abolish the carbon tax or the mining tax, although if he fails to do that, he will poison his prime ministership as surely as Gillard has poisoned hers. His first obligation is to provide the best possible administration. He has said he will restore cabinet rule, which is laudable, but if he keeps the same lineup and fails to promote talented people, people more capable of making the right calls, he and his new government will get into trouble. Count on it. Abbott's first loyalty is to the people, not his old mates from the Howard years. Some of them were not all that good. I would like now to revisit something else I said last time when I said I had never known politics to be so rough, tough and volatile, 1975 aside. That was an important proviso, which I'd like to expand on now just a little. My remarks are directed to those who relentlessly complain about the relentless negativity and toxic nature of politics today. They're either too young or too old. Their memories are either failing them or they haven't been around long enough to know what it was like. As terrible as it is today, it is nothing compared to 1975 when Fraser, spurred on by crises too many to mention, aided and abetted by Reg Withers, also known as the Toe Cutter, engineered the dismissal of a Prime Minister by the Governor-General. Back then, Labourites were organising lynch mobs against Fraser, not Lovins. So rancid was it that in late October 1975, when Whitlam was asked in Parliament about restrictions on travel and services for members, he said this: "In this context, I want to assure honourable gentlemen that the bodyguards they see accompanying the Leader of the Opposition are not to prevent other people from shooting him, but to prevent him from shooting himself." The galleries burst out laughing. I was sitting next to Peter Bowers, who was stomping his feet in unabashed delight. Imagine the outrage today if Abbott said that about Gillard. Or if in frustration during discussions with Tony Windsor, Abbott told him to go copulate with himself. That is what the Republican Speaker of the US House of Representatives, John Boehner, told the Democrat Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid at the height of negotiations to stop the US going over the fiscal cliff. And he said it twice, in a much more direct way. If you've seen that great movie Argo, you'll know exactly what he said. In Boehner's defence, Reid had called him a dictator. So, while it's easy to convince ourselves, given everything we've seen in the past few years, that things are really bad, it has been a lot worse, and compared to some other places, we're not so bad at all.
Ramson.
Thanks, Jared. Thank you, all of you, for coming. It's a great pleasure to be back here at the Sydney Institute talking about politics in 2013. There's no place, I think, in this great city for an informed discussion about the big issues in which we all have a stake. And it's good to be here again with Nikki Saver, my colleague from The Australian. I'm still writing columns on Mondays, but Nikki's column has now moved from Tuesdays to Thursdays. I think she's trying to put a bit of distance between us, but it won't work tonight because we're on a double bill. So let me start also with a scorecard on what I said last year about politics in 2012 and how I went in hindsight. I'm sure that if I don't do that, Jared or perhaps Nancy will do it for me. Now, I argued that it was hard to think of anything that could save the Gillard government from defeat at the next election. I said the major parties lacked policy credibility in a raft of areas, and that they faced significant organisational challenges as their membership has hollowed out and their community links have weakened. These assessments remain unchanged. I also said that Tony Abbott was the most unpopular opposition leader in the history of Australian opinion polling. While that comment, in terms of depth and length of unpopularity, is still true, Abbott's personal ratings have improved relative to Julia Gillard. According to last week's news poll, Abbott has regained his lead as preferred Prime Minister, registering 40% to Julia Gillard's 36%. His net satisfaction rating, which is his approval rating minus his disapproval rating, is minus 22%. Hardly a ringing endorsement, yet Gillard's net approval is minus 28%. The only thing that Gillard had over Abbott, given Labor's primary vote is stuck at record lows in the early 30s and is well behind on a two-party preferred basis, was her relative popularity to Tony Abbott, while in the last few weeks that has vanished. I also noted last year that a leadership challenge by Kevin Rudd was not only inevitable, but the word I used was imminent. And as Nikki also said, just a day after we spoke here last year, Kevin Rudd announced his resignation from the ministry, precipitating a leadership showdown with Julia Gillard. After what I think was the worst leadership challenge in the history of Australian politics ever mounted, he was trounced by 71 votes to 31. It was the largest winning margin by a Prime Minister who has ever faced a leadership challenge. But of the three previous Prime Ministers who have faced a leadership vote, being John Gordon, Malcolm Fraser and Bob Hawke, none of them went on to unite their party or to win the next election. It is a bad omen for Julia Gillard. So the big question this year, I think, overlaying politics in 2013, is will Kevin Rudd replace Julia Gillard before the next election? It's a question we cannot avoid, and it was right for Nikki to discuss it, and so will I. Rudd replacing Gillard is the only factor which I believe has the potential, and I stress the word potential, to stop Tony Abbott becoming Australia's 28th Prime Minister in September. Whatever your view is about Rudd or Gillard, the reality is that all of the available polling evidence shows that if Rudd returned, he would improve Labor's chances at the next election. Indeed, one of the most ironic polls I've seen of recent days was in Fairfax newspapers last week, which showed that Treasurer Wayne Swan, who famously said Rudd does not hold any Labor values, would lose his seat of Lilly if Gillard remained as Prime Minister, but he would win his seat if Rudd returned as Prime Minister. Rudd Redux is the game changer. It would upend Australian politics and it would dramatically recast the election campaign however soon it happens before that polling day. Whether it would save Labor, I don't know. I also have serious doubts that a leadership change is likely or indeed inevitable, as many commentators have suggested. Of course, Rudd wants to be Prime Minister again. But consider the downside for Rudd returning this side of an election and then failing to win that election. First, Julia Gillard and Wayne Swan will escape some of the blame for the government's demise. They will argue rightly that Rudd would then must shoulder some of the responsibility for the defeat. Second, if Rudd leads Labor to a defeat, then it is more likely the Labor caucus will opt for Bill Shorten or Greg Combe as their new leader post an election. Rudd has not ruled out leading Labor in opposition, where, as a popular former Prime Minister, he could possibly chart a comeback. It has, after all, been done before. Rudd's closest supporters concede, however, that winning an election is unlikely, even if he is returned before the election. His mission, if it's offered and if he accepts it, will be to save seats, not to win a third term. But Rudd will not challenge. Gillard is highly unlikely to resign. To hand over to Rudd would be a repudiation of the leadership coup that she was drafted for and then inevitably led, and also her prime ministership ever since. There is no party elder with the weight to force Gillard to abdicate. The prospect of faction leaders who were once behind Julie Gillard's elevation, such as Bill Shorten, switching to Rudd, is remote at best. Pressed to sketch out a scenario conducive to a leadership change, party figures have told me, for example, that first there must be a clear shift to Rudd among caucus members. How this happens, what form it takes, I don't know. Neither do they. Second, they would then have to use these numbers to force Julie Gillard to resign. Again, how this happens, what form it takes, nobody knows. And third, they would then have to persuade Rudd that, provided Julie Gillard has agreed to go, that he can then return to the job and work as Prime Minister without too much destabilisation. If there is a caucus stampede for Rudd, how will the inevitable cabinet resignations be managed? Gillard and Swan will not serve under Rudd. Given what they said about Rudd, how on earth could Tony Burke, Stephen Conroy and Peter Garrett and others serve in a Rudd cabinet? The Gillard camp will fight any leadership change to the death. Still, Rudd supporters are confident that Gillard will eventually be forced to resign, as perhaps due to more bad polls, a serious blunder or a scandal that which could spark a leadership change. Those who have been analysing the numbers suggest Rudd is still probably sub 40 votes in a caucus of 102. But a bunch of MPs are now regarded as undecided. That is essentially what has happened in the past few months. The New South Wales Labor Party, led by Sam Dastyari, is staying out of it for now, and that only spells trouble for Julie Gillard, particularly if MPs are now undecided. The Gillard camp says that Rudd is treacherous and disloyal, that he lacks Labor values, that his popularity is illusionary, and that he led a chaotic and dysfunctional government. To change leaders again, they say, would invite ridicule from voters. Tell that to the Victorian Liberal Party. The Rudd camp says that Gillard has lost the trust of voters with broken promises. She continually makes errors of poor judgment, and she lacks credibility, and she will lead Labor to a slaughter. It's worth pausing for a second to note that Labor's result in 2010, when Julie Gillard was Prime Minister, was already worse in a primary vote sense than Paul Keating received in 1996, or Gough Whitlam received in 1975 or 1977. They say that Rudd will save seats. But if Labor is considering Rudd redux, then it must formulate an effective transition plan. Otherwise, a leadership change that would be Labor's fifth in 10 years is far from inevitable. Yet, for all that, it cannot be ruled out. So, what does the party do with Kevin Rudd? As always, he's everywhere. He is a perpetual reminder of the leadership coup, which voters never liked, and he is far more popular than Julia Gillard. Party sources say he can easily win his Queensland seat of Griffith, and he will. Recently, Simon Crean, Bill Shorten and Anthony Albanese have described him as an asset to be used in the campaign. Maybe. But he is a reminder of things best forgotten in an election year. As a senior party figure said to me recently, whenever he is out on the campaign trail, he may be an asset, but he simply reminds voters that he was replaced with an unpopular leader who today is untrusted by voters. In October 2010, I recorded a long interview with Kevin Rudd, not all of which has yet been published. He had lost the prime ministership just 3 months earlier. He had been foreign minister for 3 weeks. On his mind were two things: his place in history and his future. "I'll be around for a while yet," Rudd said. He also said, "Politics is a funny business, mate. We never know how it's going to turn out." Indeed, we don't. but at least in 6 months' time, we'll still know who won the election. Although the spectre of Rudd Redux overlays politics in 2013, just as it did in 2010 and 2011 and 2012, it is not the only factor shaping politics this year. Julia Gillard's announcement of an election date, 227 days before it was to be held, baffled the party's most experienced campaign professionals. It ceded a huge advantage, a tactical advantage, to the coalition, who can now plan their campaign logistics to a firm date. Everything, from advertising to polling and focus groups, campaign teams, flights and cars and accommodation, the leave of staff, campaign operatives and candidates, signs being printed, events being scheduled, all of that can now be done without any guesswork. By announcing the date, voters will also view much of what the government now does as campaigning rather than governing. And this is precisely what happened this week in Western Sydney. The timing of the announcement, of course, couldn't be any worse. It was bookended on one side with suspended Labor MP Craig Thompson's arrest and the corruption hearings into the New South Wales government. And then just after, there was the resignation of Chris Evans and Nicola Roxon, plus a speech by Tony Sheldon, the party's vice president, who said Labor was suffering a crisis of belief brought on by a lack of moral and political purpose. This is in the week that you launch an election campaign. One of Gillard's biggest challenges, I think, this year, after so many broken promises, so many policy blunders, and so many political stunts gone bad, is that few voters believe anything she says. In politics, trust is the coin of the realm. It is hard to gain, but it is easy to lose. And on Sunday, Julia Gillard made a pitch for the hearts and minds of voters in Western Sydney, promising to deliver 5 things to make your life easier. She said they were Aussie jobs, broadband, improving education, better health and disability services, and help to manage what she said was the pressures of modern family life. You'll hear more about those things, some of them inexplicably definable, and also more about local roads, public transport, and crime. It'll probably be a federal election as close as we get to a state election in recent memories. And of course, the Western Sydney Blitz this week, including a sleepover in Rudy Hill, has undermined anything Julia Gillard has said or done in this past week. Not even race baiting and economic nationalism or pure Hansenism over 457 visas, for example, will save Labor. Indeed, this is a new low for Labor, even though we most often hear racially tinged statements from the likes of the Liberals' Scott Morrison. It is not old Labor, it's not Hawke and Keating Labor, it's reminiscent of a generation before them, indeed. This week is the 30th anniversary of Bob Hawke leading Labor to power in 1983. Recently, I interviewed Gareth Evans, who he highlighted for me the elements of Hawke's success, worth remembering in an election year. He said, with strong leadership, a strong team, strong organisational discipline, a strong policy focus and a willingness to argue hard cases rather than be driven by focus group angst, you can not only have a very good government, but an electorally successful government. And I think in addition to a talented cabinet with a diversity of experiences, the Hawke years were disciplined, focused and a pragmatic government which was dedicated to economic and social reform. Kim Beazley told me just last week, nobody but Hawke seemed better placed. Certainly no one else was more likely to build a public consensus around a deep process of reform. And as a quick aside, this is why I was pleased that Bob Hawke launched my new book of great political speeches, which is available here tonight, as Jared has mentioned. I think that the words that join together to make a political speech is the oldest form of political communication. A speech is the most effective way to present an argument by linking policies, political messaging and philosophy into a framework for persuading the public. But I think amid flashes of great speechmaking today, the art of oratory and the quality of public discourse is sadly in decline. Most speeches would win accolades for their ability to spin a political message rather than win a complex argument. So learning from some of the greatest speeches over the past century couldn't be more timelier. or indeed learning from that Hawke model, who practiced consensus politics. He rejected the politics of division and class warfare. He worked with business, unions and the social welfare sector, and he successfully communicated that case for reform. And the policies that he and Paul Keating delivered energised productivity, and they produced more competitive and efficient markets. They were fundamental to economic prosperity and social progress. Without these reforms, we would not have the great enterprising, aspirational middle class in places like Western Sydney. But many of these voters today are indeed alienated by the party that created the opportunities that they had to improve their lives. Today in The Australian, I wrote the first account of Mark Latham's quarterly essay, which is due out next week. He urges the party to rid itself of union-based factionalism, rent-seeking union influence on policy, and to recapture Paul Keating's economic legacy. The party is confused on economic policy, Latham argues, not only whether it is to embrace the Keating legacy of microeconomic reform and productivity growth, or to accede to the sectional demands of union and factional bosses and the anti-competitive comfort of industry welfare. And he's right. These are big challenges for Labor, and how it addresses them, if it does so at all, will determine if the party remains a viable political force into the future. Labor strategists say that the May budget will be the last big chance to sway voter support back to the government. This will also be a test for Tony Abbott and the Liberal Party. Abbott's reply to the budget, I think, will provide a key opportunity to present costed and funded policies within a philosophical framework for governing. We are yet to see an effective speech from Abbott that unites his policies with his approach to government and his personal values. Abbott's advisers know this, and we know they know it, because recently an email from one of Abbott's advisers was leaked, which argued for more of the, quote, vision thing in speeches. However, Abbott replied that he just wanted the media to think he was, quote, a good bloke. This statement underscores the concern about Abbott's low personal approval ratings, even though he now outrates Gillard. One coalition MP told me recently that we're about to see the shift to the real Tony, or positive Tony, which is going to be addressed in three key ways. First is the message that Abbott is a common man, as Margie Abbott just has described him recently. So picture Abbott, the family man, the community firefighter, and the athlete raising money for charity. Second, he is conservative on most issues, like his mentor John Howard, which may appeal to voters as the political pendulum swings away from Labor. And third, Abbott has experience as a minister in government, which neither Rudd nor Gillard had. This will be used to create the perception that Abbott will lead with stability and capability after years of blunders and backflips, scandals and crises. But some coalition MPs are worried about the lacklustre C-team from the Howard years dominating the shadow ministry. They're worried about the potential for policy errors, and they're worried about Abbott's perennial habit of putting his foot in his mouth, exaggerating and overreaching. But Abbott looks set to lead the coalition parties to victory. But I don't think there is yet a detailed plan for governing, or that the voters have a very good sense of what he is. It may simply be that they know he is not Kevin Rudd and he is not Julia Gillard. Labor will exploit Abbott's promise to slash $70 billion from the budget and abolish the carbon and mining taxes, while also promising that people will be better off under his government. His $3.2 billion direct action climate change policy, I think, is one of the worst policies ever proposed by a major political party. It is inefficient, it's costly, and it's proven by experts, whether in the climate science field or in economics or business, that it will achieve almost nothing. I can't see any evidence as to how their border protection policy will stop boats coming. None. He's putting a tax on business to pay paternity leave. And he's promised to fully fund the National Disability Insurance Scheme and a new dental program under Medicare. He's going to the election without a plan to reform industrial relations. He's got Andrew Robb in full agrarian socialist mode, promising a food bowl in the north and dams all over the place. None of this reflects the Liberal Party of John Howard. None of it. Nevertheless, Labor is likely headed for a landslide defeat, which, on the strength of the economy alone, will rewrite the political rule books. The rebuilding process for Labor will be long and hard. An Abbott government, unthinkable just a few years ago, will not be trouble-free. No government ever is. But Labor is the one today in deep trouble. And as the election falls on the Jewish day of Yom Kippur, the party will not be able to escape its Day of Atonement. Thank you.
Thanks to both our speakers. Thanks to Clayton Ute for the use of this fine facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got about 20 minutes. There are a lot of people here. We've got two speakers. So if you just make your point or your question to one of the speakers and everyone will get a fair go. I should have mentioned when I introduced everyone that Nikki Sava, in her career, among other things, has worked for Peter Costello and John Howard, and Troy Bramston, in his career, among other things, worked for Kevin Rudd. So we come to questions and discussion. There's a question there, but we've got to be brief. Okay, now if I get you two to stand up here, I'll disappear over here and take them as they come. Yep.
To Nikki Sava, were you being ironic when you said that Malcolm Turnbull would be a team player in an Abbott government, given that he really, really, really wants to be PM and everything that he says can be interpreted in many different ways in that frame?
Okay.
A slight piece of irony, yes. I was referring to an interview that he did with The Australian last week, where he placed heavy emphasis on cabinet government under Abbott. And my take out on that was that Malcolm sees himself as having a lot of input into that government, that it's not going to be Tony out there governing on his own, but he, Tony, is going to be having a fair bit to say about what goes on. Well, we'll see about that.
I may get you to talk to the end of the room because that pick up more on the microphone. Okay, so we're this question down the back. Yeah.
You both referred to the need for Abbott to replace members of the existing shadow cabinet and promote young talent. Who's in and who's out?
I think he does need to promote people like Matthias Cormann, who I think is a real talent in the Senate. He's only assistant shadow treasurer at the moment. I do think he needs to promote Arthur Sinodinos, despite the fact that Arthur's had a couple of problems recently. I think those sort of things will pass and he will be a solid foundation for an economics team. I think Christian Porter, who was the former state treasurer in Western Australia, will also have a lot to contribute. I have a bit of a thing about Kevin Andrews, who was a minister in the Howard government, and I always regarded him as one of the least successful ministers in the Howard government, and I would be, very disappointed, and I think it would be a great shame if he was to be given a senior portfolio when there are so many other good people on the back bench who I think deserve a go. I think Kevin's had his go.
Okay, so Lindsay.
Troy, you spoke about Rudd's mission. What do you think of the hypothesis that's been suggested that Rudd would prefer to stand back, watch the Labor Party be annihilated because he hates the unions so much, and then come in after the election as leader of the opposition to rebuild the Labor Party without the union base or with a much diminished union base?
Absolutely. He's thinking about that. That is front of mind. As I indicated, there are two things halting, I guess, his ambition to come back now, apart from being hemmed in by the promise not to challenge and all those factional problems, is that he would be saddled with the defeat that would tarnish his legacy, and Gillard and Swan would be off the hook. And the second one is, as you say, it would then really diminish his chance of leading in opposition. And I think that Kevin is going to win his seat at Griffith. He has no other plans to do anything else. He's going to be there for a long time. And he would be thinking that as an option for him to try to rebuild his political stocks and lead Labor in opposition, perhaps not first up. He might let Greg Combey or Bill Shorten go forth first, and that would only be a distraction for them if he's then still on the back bench. But that is definitely a factor in his thinking. And the reality is, of all the possible leadership candidates, Rudd is the only one who would be prepared to take on the factions and take on the union control of the Labor Party. So that'll be something the people will have to consider. And another quick point is that the dynamics of the caucus will impact on that decision very, very much. So it'll be vastly depleted if the polls are correct, and that will then dictate where the support comes from and who can then muster the numbers. We'd expect that the New South Wales Right will lose some of its members. The Victorian Right will probably remain the same. And the left would remain very strong, and most of the left, if not all of them, would go with Kevin Rudd.
Can I just add something there? After watching the Howard Peacock wars go on for years, it took 5 election defeats for them to sort out their problems. And it seems to me that after the election, if they lose, I think there would be a lot of people who would want to draw a line under the Gillard-Rudd affairs. And possibly go to a new leader, say a Combey. Now, whether that works or not, and Kevin bides his time and comes back, I think they will want to go for something new, and they would probably be best to do that.
But just quickly on that, in response, one of the biggest problems Labor's going to have to confront in opposition is organisational reform and trade union influence. And the last thing the Labor Party, you'd think, would want to do is put another trade union leader as their first leader. After an election, so you know that might actually work in Rudd's favour.
Just looking at Rudd and looking at history, those who've come back after a massive defeat have been Howard, Menzies to some extent, and there was a period in the wilderness where they learned things. When I look at Rudd, I can't see any evidence that he's learned anything. It's always about Rudd, and anyone who's ever worked with him when he was head of premiers in Queensland, and no doubt majority of Labor MPs, realise he's not very good at organisation, he's not a team player, and it looks to me like while he might win a presidential election in the United States, this is about a Westminster-style system, and that this might be the very poison chalice for Labor to bring back. Can you comment on whether or not Rudd's learnt anything? Because he's had a very small time in the wilderness, and it hasn't really been a wilderness, and there's a lot that he needs.
Okay, we're up to 2 psychological assessments. Dr. Bramston and then Dr. Sava.
Well, it's pretty hard to know at this stage because he can't really say much publicly, and it's not the time to be relaunching himself as a newly reinvented political leader. But he has admitted some mistakes. I mean, he's admitted the climate change, the abolition of the proceeding with the CPRS was a mistake. He did fess up to that. But time will tell. I mean, I think that, you know, Rudd did lead a chaotic and dysfunctional government. He is not very well liked by the caucus. But, you know, if you've ever walked with him through a shopping centre or an airport or down a street, the bloke is phenomenally popular. And people might go, well, that's illusionary and they're not real people and he's just a celebrity and all that kind of stuff. But having seen it and experienced it many times, I'm telling you it's real. And there is a very strong reservoir of support for Rudd in the Australian community, which may not be there inside the Labor Party.
Nikki?
I think the issue is not so much how much Rudd has learned, but how much the Labor Party has learned as well. And if Rudd does come back, I think they will need to make sure that his office is vastly different this time from what it was last time, and that the Cabinet operates a lot differently this time from last time. It seemed to me that they are all too willing to let him go along with what he wanted to do. I think he will need a lot of people to be very firm with him and to sit on him this time and not let him get away with, you don't think they'll do it. Well, if they don't...
He won't do that.
He won't do that, but he has to have people around him who will sit on him, I think, and keep him in line. Otherwise, he'll just go the same as he did last time.
Robert.
Rudd leadership would require a new cabinet.
Troy, would you like to run through who you see, how that might be constructed?
Well, we know there would be two people not there, that it would be Swan and Gillard, that they'd be gone. It's questionable whether or not there actually is enough humble pie in the nation for people like Tony Burke and Peter Garrett and Stephen Conroy to eat, but they would have to eat it live on national television if they wanted to remain in his cabinet. Jason Clare is certainly the best in the outer ministry who's not in cabinet. He's cabinet secretary, but he's not a cabinet minister. He would probably come in. It's also possible that that Rob McClellan could come back in a stopgap sense before the next election. I think probably the best person who Labor hasn't promoted, which they should, is Andrew Lee. He is a former economics professor from ANU. He really should be in the outer ministry, if not in cabinet. He would be obvious off the top of my head.
Could I bring you to foreign affairs? Do you have any confidence in Julie Bishop as foreign affairs minister? And do you think Bob Carr might have some leadership ambition?
Well, Nikki, why don't you respond on Julie Bishop? Briefly.
Well, yeah, look, she might not, come up as one of the best foreign affairs ministers ever, but she probably wouldn't be one of the first, one of the worst either. And I remember back to the time when Alexander Downer was first appointed. He made a series of mistakes and he looked very shaky for a while, and then he managed to get a grip and actually perform in his portfolio very well. And I mean, Julie is a smart woman. She's not dumb, so I think she will apply herself. She might not have the flair of a Carr. She might read her briefs a bit more closely than a Carr. I think he tends to wing it a bit sometimes, because he has this thing about, sort of knowing more than everybody else does about everything. So, I think she will discharge the duties there reasonably well.
I take a comment from Troy about Bob Carr as a possible leadership alternative.
Bob Carr is interesting in the sense that I don't think he wants to return to the leadership. He would obviously have to move to the lower house, and that's not going to happen. I mean, he did, 7 years as opposition leader in New South Wales, which he described as hell, and 10 years as premier, which was probably only marginally better. So I don't think he wants to return to the leadership. But the interesting question about Carr is, what is he going to do after the election, assuming Labor loses? He said when he was announced as foreign minister that he can see himself as a US-style senator who is, an ageing 90-year-old still, prowling around the Senate dispensing political wisdom. I can see Carr doing that perfectly. He told me a few months ago that he loves nothing more on a lazy Saturday afternoon than to pick up the mobile phone and ring Kim Beazley and talk about American politics. So he loves politics, so I can see him staying there, but you'd have to think most likely is that he would get out pretty quickly, because the travel from Sydney to Canberra, being in opposition, is not something to look forward to.
He'd always write up a backdated version of his diaries. It's a great Labor tradition. You write up what you didn't write up at the time, you write it up later. The Clive Cameron approach to political diaries. Yeah. Down the back.
With Tony Abbott's personal approval rating improving from a very low base, after all the criticism that came personally to him from the Labor side, was the misogyny speech just that step too far for Labor? It seems to have been, he's improved since then.
Well, I think it did go too far. I think there was probably an initial flush where everybody thought, this is fantastic, she's speaking to women about, things that rankle with them. But after a bit, I think that wore off and people started thinking a bit more seriously about it and started having a bit of a closer look at Abbott and realising that it just didn't wash. I mean, they were pretty serious charges to level against a person, that they were sexist and misogynist. And I think now people realise that that was over the top.
Question here. Yep.
Will Mr. Dreyfus keep his seat, and what role do you think he may have if he
Will Mark Dreyfus keep his seat, and what role would he have in opposition if Labor goes into opposition? Troy.
Yeah, I don't think Labor will probably lose any seats in Victoria at this stage. They most likely would probably win back the seat of Melbourne as well, from Adam Bandt, the Green. Mark Dreyfus is an interesting character. He hasn't been in Parliament very long. I can't see any reason why he'd want to bow out. But he's probably playing a little bit more of a factional role behind the scenes that hasn't really been picked up. I wrote an account for The Australian about the internal dynamics inside the government about the Palestine-Israel vote issue on Palestine's observer status. And what I discovered in that process was that Dreyfus was playing a big role in leading the Victorian right forces in support of Julia Gillard behind the scenes. I won't go into all the detail now, but you can pick it up from the Australian website. But interesting character, understated, not in the public view, but he's playing a big role behind the scenes.
We're getting towards the end. Nikki, what about the prospects of what the Liberals might do with their preferences in Melbourne? Do you think they'll preference Labor, or will they preference Adam Bandt again?
I think they will definitely preference Labor, but their thinking at this stage is that, well, at least until the Baillieu thing happened, which kind of might change the dynamics a bit, their view then was that Bandt would probably increase his vote by, say, about 5%, and the Liberal vote would also go up slightly at Labor's expense. And although they would be preferencing Labor ahead of the Greens, there would be a lot of leakage of Liberal preferences, probably about 30%, which is what happened at the state election. So if he increases his vote and he gets that substantial leakage of Liberal preferences, that could just push him over the line. So it's not beyond the realms that Bandt will be re-elected.
But you think the Liberals will preference Labor?
Labor, but there will be leakage of preferences from Labor to the Greens.
And we're right near the end, so we've got, I think, a question. Have I missed anyone? Lindsay.
Each of you has worked in the office of a Prime Minister.
Second last question, okay.
Each of you has worked in the office of a Prime Minister. I wonder whether you want to comment on the role of John McTiernan and whether the myth is greater than the reality or the other way around.
It's a question about the kilt man.
I actually think he's not doing a bad job, although he does love the limelight a bit, which I think is probably not so good for a staffer. Staffers are meant to hold back a bit, but he's not averse to getting out there himself. And I actually think he does a reasonable job for Gillard. At the end, you can have the best staffers in the world, but you have to get out there and do it yourself. So it's not so much about him, it's about her.
Troy?
I've been on the receiving end of the odd text message or email from John McTiernan, which if I showed it to you, would make your hair stand on end.
I think I've had the reverse. I've had very complimentary.
So that's why you're speaking well about him.
So it's clear that he's clearly promoting himself to columnists, at least. And that's part of the problem, is that staffers should never be part of the story. And he's too much part of the story, which is distracting from Julia Gillard, so he's not serving her particularly well, although I have heard from a few journos that he's now blaming others in the office for everything that's gone wrong.
Well, he's never contacted me, but Mark Carlton asked him for a cup of tea and he didn't get back to him, so... Mark's very upset. He had all this advice to give him. Right down the back. No, right down the back. The last question up against the back wall. I'll call that first. Yep?
Troy, my question is to you. You said before one potential objective of Kevin Rudd coming back to Labor leadership would be to have an election result that completely destroyed the union movement, or at least limited its influence over the AFP. This is a really radical thing for the left of Australian politics. The union movement is a central organising principle of the centre-left of Australian politics. It's why the Labor Party is the Labor Party, as Julia Gillard said at the AWU conference. She said, it's not a social democratic party, it's not a progressive party, Labor Party. What would be Kevin Rudd's single organising principle to shape the centre-left of Australian politics via the ALP without a strong trade union?
Well, the trade unions have always been part of the Labor Party, but the Labor Party previously had a strong grassroots membership. You know, it was 50,000 members in the 1990s. It was 150,000 in the 1930s. It was always a grassroots movement that wasn't just reliant on trade unions. So the job for Labor will be to re-establish those community links. And without going into all the details now, you know, community pre-selections where the public have a say is one way of doing that. It's a galvanising idea, perhaps allowing the Labor Party to directly have members of the public directly elect its leader, like almost every other centre-left and some right-wing parties do around the world, is another. So Labor, I don't think, needs the unions in an organisational sense, in a community-building sense. It can rely on mainstream Australians do that like it used to in the past. But the reality is that Labor Party is going to have to face the question of reform and face the question of union influence. And union influence all comes back to one single thing, is the trade unions have 50% of the control of Labor Party conferences, and from there you control policy, candidates and the party organisation. And that's got to be addressed. But the reality is the record of Labor Party reform, whether it was Gough Whitlam in the 60s or Bill Hayden in the 70s, can only be led by the leader if it's going to succeed, because you've got to take on those vested interests. And the only person who can do that in the Labor Party today with any chance of success is Kevin Rudd.
Nikki, do you want to add a comment on that? No?
I agree.
Okay. We could be very quick here. It'd be very quick. What do you want? Yep.
If both Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Abbott would be run over by a bus, whom do you see as alternative Liberal leader?
So if both Turnbull and Abbott were not in the picture, who would be the alternative Liberal leader? That's the final comment. Yeah.
Before the election?
Or before the election and after the election. So who's the next
just
one?
Just to make it easy.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the most likely before the election would be Joe Hockey.
Yeah. And who would know?
After the election, it depends who's left standing. I suspect Scott Morrison.
Yeah, I'll just quickly add to that. In some of my dealings in the business community around Sydney and elsewhere, the name that keeps popping up as someone a bit off that field is Scott Morrison. So when you go through, you know, Abbott, Turnbull and Hockey, the name that I keep hearing is Morrison. He's the one for the future.
And I think Nikki Sava first mentioned him on Insiders over a year ago.
I did, yes.
I remember these things. Many thanks.
Pleasure.
Me to retire. We're right on time. As I said, there's copies of Troy's latest book, edited book on great Labor speeches. There's been a terrific night tonight. We had two well-written and well-presented speeches and then a very interesting exchange in the question discussion period where our speakers covered a whole range of topics. So thanks to you for the questions and the comments, and thanks to Troy Bramston and Nikki Sava for the responses. I think we all learned a lot tonight, and their speeches from a year ago stand up very well, and I'm pretty sure that in a year's time these speeches will stand up well, but we'll get them back and find out next year. Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.